listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. Sons of Anarchy meets the departed in this fast-paced high-wire act memoir from former ATF agent Ken Croak, the first federal agent in history to go undercover and successfully infiltrate the infamous and infamously violent Pagan Motorcycle Club, a white supremacist biker gang. Longtime ATF agent Ken Croak had earned the right to coast to the end of a storied career, having routinely gone undercover to apprehend white supremacists, gun runners, and gang members. But after a chance encounter with an associate of the Pagan Motorcycle Gang created an opening, he transformed himself into Slam, a monstrous axe-handle-wielding enforcer whose duty was to protect the leadership mother club at all costs. He befriended the club's most violent and criminally insane members and lived among them for 2 years, covertly building a case that would eventually take down the top members of the gang in a massive federal prosecution, even as he risked his marriage, his sanity, and his life. With today's law enforcement largely moving toward the comparative safety of cyber operations, it became one of the last of its kind, a masterclass in old-school tactics that marked Croak as a dying breed of undercover agent and became legendary in law enforcement. Now, for the first time, Croak tells a story of his terrifying undercover life in the Pagans, the unspeakable violence, extremism, drugs, and disgusting rituals. Written with best-selling crime writer Dave Wedge and utilizing the exclusive cooperation of those who lived the case with him, as well as thousands of pages of court files and hours of surveillance tapes and photos, Croak delivers a frightening, nail-biting account of the secretive and brutal biker underworld. The book that we're featuring this evening is Riding with Evil, Taking Down the Notorious Pagan Motorcycle Gang, with my special guest, former ATF agent and author, Ken Croak. Welcome to the program, and thank you so much for this interview, Ken Croak.
Thanks, Dan. Happy to be here.
Thank you so much for joining us this evening with this incredible tale. Let's get right to this. In 2008, you write that a call came into the field office, the Boston office of the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives, ATF, where you were a supervisor. This person had a connection with the Devil's Disciples, which was a support group of the Pagans. Tell us what this person had to say, this Jake. What did he have to say, and how you initially got involved?
Yeah, Jake had come in and had met with one of the agents, Eric Cochin, from the Boston office, and had said that he had some information on the Devil's Disciples and that he knew they were recruiting new members and that he knew they were involved in some illegal activities. And he thought that he could do some work or introduce an undercover agent into that group, you know, if that's something that law enforcement would want.
Now, the person that took that call is a person named Eric Cochin, and he was an agent that took the call. He spoke to you. Why did he ask you? What was your background that he was interested in? And tell us about this conversation you had regarding this.
Sure. So early in my career, I started in Los Angeles, California. And so I worked a lot of gang investigations. In particular, I worked a lot of motorcycle gangs. And so I was involved in investigations with the Mongols and the Vagos and some others. And the agents in Boston, when I was transferred back to Boston eventually, knew that I had this background. There hadn't been a lot of outlaw and motorcycle gang investigations in the Boston office. And so when this information came in, you know, part of Cochin's due diligence was, well, let me talk to a resource who knows a bit about, you know, these gangs and to find out if this story matches, if it has credibility, you know, the structure of gangs and kind of their makeup and hearing about different things they may be doing. There's kind of a validity check, if you will. Like, does this make sense?
Right.
who's worked these types of investigations.
Right. So you brought this Jake character in, or they brought Jake in, and they first off to vet him, they gave him a polygraph test and he passed. So from there, how do you get involved? And what's this of this fateful event that happens with this Boston Mike?
Yeah, it's one of those things where you could plan out, you know, all sorts of things and different ways to go about investigations. And then, you know, somebody else has a plan for you. And in this particular instance, Jake passes the polygraph. So that's step number one. Like, okay, this person isn't coming in. They're not lying about this or, you know, trying to set up an undercover agent. There's all sorts of different, you know, reasons why somebody could come in with false info. And so you pass that first test. And then second test is like, all right, if somebody's going to go undercover, and again, it was never the intent to do a long-term investigation, undercover investigation, that is. But even if it was going to be short-term, you had to look at the person, Jake, but you also have to look at his surroundings. So if I was going to be the undercover, and initially that was not the plan, but if I was, if Jake has a wife or adult children or whatever that is in his life, and they're involved in this setting,
right,
then you have to check that part out too, because you can't just have somebody that's never met anybody in his family. You know, if your backstory is that you're with them, then they would have to know you. So I needed to meet, in this case, it was just his wife, to see what her makeup was. Was this somebody who was going to be able to stand up to this, you know, type of work?
And she passed the test. And then what happens with Boston Bob and Jake, and how are you involved?
So it starts with Boston Mike. And so Boston Mike, you know, I was actually helping. It was freezing cold, and there was a hot water heater that froze up. It's kind of a long, convoluted story, but anyways, when we were helping to get this hot water heater going, Boston Mike shows up on the scene and introduces himself, and he knows Jake, and so they're talking, and then eventually, you know, I start talking and just kind of hanging out, you know, BSing a bit. And it comes up that they were having a party in the upcoming weeks. And he's like, hey, if your buddy wants to come along, you know, have him come along. So it was an opportunity. It wasn't a planned opportunity. It wasn't like, oh, let's set the stage and, you know, so we can do this introduction. It just happened, which, you know, at the time, you didn't know how far this was going to go. But it was like, okay, well, it makes sense now that I'm going to be at least the one to go initially. And I the plan at that time was, okay, I'll start it and then I'll hand it off to somebody else. But, you know, as events turn, that wasn't an option.
So you report back to Kochian, and there's at least a short-term surveillance plan set up. And you just said that things moved really fast right after that. Normally, the kinds of precautions you do as an undercover agent, it was interesting to read about it. And you talk about the term backstopping. So explain everything that normally you would have done. And in this regard, you already had an alias and from previous undercover work. Tell us what all goes into building that kind of, as you call it, backstopping.
Yeah, and we keep, in the book, we outline some of it, but it's really the common sense part. There's other things that are farther and more in detail that we don't talk about just because we're not going to give up the technology or the techniques. But the point is that if you're going to take on the identity or the persona, just simple things, you know, Dan, you get junk mail at your house. You, you know, you have a driver's license. You have these things that seem simple because they're legit. You got them just by living your life. But when you have an undercover life, it's not as easy. And I know most people would love to see no junk mail show up in their mailbox. But if you don't have any junk mail, that looks weird. If you don't have flyers outside your house, those kind of things. So you have to create this persona and so that it becomes as close or as real as it can to what a real, you know, person is. And that those real types of things, solicitations and things like that would happen to that person. Because these organizations, they look for that. You know, when you get far enough in, if you're just showing up at one party, nobody's checking any of that stuff. You show up at a couple of parties, nobody's checking it. But all of a sudden you're joining one of these kind of elite organizations, if you will, they are going to check this stuff and you better have the stuff lined up in order to get through it. Because if you get compromised, you know, who knows where it goes from there.
So you go to this party and it's not really a party, as you say, and they're trying to find out information about you. So who are the people that you meet right away and what is the talk almost right away?
There's, you know, again, they're saying that they're trying to, you know, figure out who I am and all that, it sounds more diligent or more purposeful than it really is. You know, it's like anybody who goes to a party, like these guys weren't saying out of the gate, like, oh, hey, this guy here, Ken, we want to bring him in and make him one of us. Like that wasn't what the intent of this was. I was just invited to a party. But for me, it's a job and it's an opportunity to assess who's who. And then for the others, it's, you know, for them, it's just like, hey, what's this guy about? You know, what is he, you know, is he a good guy to hang out with? You know, I don't think they're looking that far down the road where they're like, oh, hey, we want to make this guy one of us.
Okay. So tell us as you write in the book, a little bit about the pagan history as one of the five major bike gangs in the world. And also the idea of who Jake was in terms of, you say there's many ways to be involved with outlaw biker gangs, and one of them is a prospect, but explain some of the process to us and a little history of the organization.
Sure. So this particular, now a lot of the outlaw motorcycle gangs are set in a very similar structure. So this was Devil's Disciples, but the pagans have their own structure, but they're all, you know, somewhat similar. And so they have a hierarchy. So you basically, when you start and you're accepted as just a person that they like, then it's what they call the hang around phase. And that hang around phase could go from 6 months to 6 years. You just don't know how long that part of the process goes. But what that means is you can go to events, you can go to parties. You're not certainly not involved in any of the criminal activity. You're not going to church. And I'll explain what church is in a minute. You're not, you're just on the outside. You're somebody you can hang around, but they're not sharing anything, you know, particularly illegal activities with you. From there, you may get asked if you wanted to be a part of this thing. And that's exactly what they said to me. And if you agree, they put you into this prospecting phase. Prospecting is nothing anybody wants to do. It's, you know, it's a horrible period of time. But what it is, you know, the gang is saying, okay, you're going to give us all your information. We're going to do our background check, and each gang does it differently. And you are then going to go into this prospect phase. And for the pagans, it's at least 6 months long. And in the pagans, you are a prospect for the pagan nation is what they call it. So it's not to a specific chapter. And basically, you are indentured to the gang. You are on call 24/7. You do whatever they tell you to do. And a lot of it is grunt work. There are all sorts of history, rules, all of that you have to learn, and you have to do your best not to deviate or screw up on these rules. And certain things can happen to you during that time. One of the things you have to do is you carry these bags full of all sorts of stuff, extra cigarettes, spark plugs, light bulb. Like you have to have all this stuff on you, and any member at any time can say, hey, prospect, you know, give me a cigarette, or prospect, give me a, you know, I need a spark plug for my bike, whatever it is. And there was actually a list of things you had to have on. And if you screwed up, if they asked you a question, and you didn't know the answer. If they asked you a cigarette and you didn't have one, whatever it is, there's a couple different ways they would deal with it. One of the things you had to carry on you was a calendar, and you had to mark off your days as a prospect, your goal getting to 180. But there was no guarantee at 180 you were going to become a member. That was just the general time when that could happen. And so, if you screwed up, they could add days to your prospecting or weeks, which is horrible. Or they would bang check you, which is basically, they basically give you a palm strike to the head. Or they could just simply throw you out, depending on the severity of what you do. So you're under that duress the entire time. And there were prospects who were beaten with axe handles. It escalates depending on what the screw ups are. After the prospecting phase, if you were to get through it, then you become a probationary patch member. And that period lasts for a year. So you're a patch. And so you have your colors and you can attend different events. And then within the club structure, you will have the chapter president who runs the chapter. And there's certain signifiers on their colors that allow you to know that they're the chapter president. There's Sergeant Arms, who is the second highest rank in a chapter. There is a vice president, but the vice president's really only status is if the president gets killed or goes to jail. Then there's a treasurer, and in some chapters, it'd be a secretary. And then above each chapter is what they call the mother club. And the Mother Club is made up of, and so it's almost like its own chapter, but it oversees the entire pagan nation, the entire gang. And each Mother Club member would have, so there'd be a national president, national vice president, national sergeant of arms. And then, but each one of those members, and in theory, Mother Club would have 13 members. It oftentimes didn't, but in theory it would. And those Mother Club members would have areas of responsibility. So you'd have a Mother Club member that may be over New York, one over Northern New Jersey, one over Pennsylvania, or they might divide Pennsylvania. So I'll pause there, Dan.
A couple of the things that demonstrate and illustrate all of the kinds of things that you talk about, this pagan world that you are were going to enter into soon. The guys that you met, Boston Mike, and or pardon me, Boston Bob and Billy Jacobson, Bob tells you a little bit about, you talked about the rules and the rules that had to be obeyed or else harsh consequences. And Bob tells you about Billy sleeping with, I think it's a Mother Club member, but at least a pagan member's wife or girlfriend. And then also was very important is right at the very beginning, when you're considering and your ATF is considering whether you should be able to go do this, and you see the opportunity that presents itself soon enough, there's a person named Bennett. And so you talk about Bob and Billy, and you talk about a young man named Bennett and Hogman. So tell us a little bit about this Bennett and Hogman and Bob and Billy.
Sure. Yeah, so there's a lot there, and I'll unpack it piece by piece. So Boston Mike, in the Devil's Disciples, in the chapter that they were in, you had Billy Jacobson, Boston Mike, Boston Bob, and a few others. And there was talk, although I wasn't, part of this talk early on, because again, I wasn't one of them, and I wasn't certainly in their plans to patch over to become pagans, but there was talk that the pagans were going to open a chapter in Massachusetts, and that these some of the members from the Devil's Disciples were going to patch over, which means basically they would turn in their colors to their gang and they would take on pagan colors. So they wouldn't have to go through prospecting. Doesn't happen often, but sometimes when they're going to open a full chapter of regular outlaw motorcycle gang members, they'll do it. So the plan was that these five individuals were going to start this chapter up in Massachusetts. So, The interesting piece of all that was that you had Billy and Jacobson in Boston Bob, both had qualities, both seemed to have a following. So I kind of tried to stay in the middle and was successful at doing that. So I would spend time with Boston Bob, and sometimes we meet at a bar and hang out and we talk, and he'd be like, yeah, you should, think about doing this. And then other times I'd meet with Billy, and we'd meet down in South Boston, and we would go to some bars down there, and we'd hang out, and he'd be talking about how he was going to be running these things. At some point, when right as I was supposed to be going down to meet the pagans for the first time, they were going down for an event, and it was actually a memorial event for Bennett. And I'll go back to explain what happened there. And they ended up going down on Friday night. I was supposed to meet them in Long Island on Saturday night. And what had happened is, and Billy had said that he had hooked up with a female down there. He never got specific about who it was or who they might have been tied to. And I don't even know that he knew it at the time. I do know that Boston Bob had warned him and said, you should not be screwing around with any of these ladies down here, because you don't know who they're tied to, and you are going to get yourself into some trouble. And Billy, Billy was doing what Billy was going to do, and he didn't listen. So as they went down that Friday night, and they were at a bar called Mobo's on Long Island, and they were in there, and this female was there. And again, none of us ever knew the real story on what happened. I can tell you what Billy stated, and then I could tell you what others had stated. But Billy, walks in and is seen by this woman, and but Billy doesn't see her, but she sees him. And so she makes a comment to her boyfriend, who happens to be the president of one of the New Jersey chapters, and says, hey, this guy over here, see him over there. He raped me some weeks ago. Now, that may have happened. According to Boston Bob, he said it didn't happen, that they had had a consensual relationship, but that she was panicking because of what her, you know, new boyfriend would say. But I don't know. It could have happened either way. Billy walks into a situation he doesn't even know is going to happen. So oftentimes illegal activity, particularly when you're in one of these biker bars, it happens in the bathrooms. And so the bathrooms, you know, there'll be people posted outside the bathrooms. And if somebody's in there selling drugs, buying drugs, using drugs, or, you know, any meetings or whatever, they'll block the door. So the pagans will block the door and not allow folks in when their leadership was inside doing whatever they're doing. So in this particular situation, Billy got summoned to the bathroom. And so he's thinking, this is about the new chapter. This is great. You know, they're probably going to name me the president. You know, this is all good. And so he walks through the door and several pagans are inside the bathroom, four to be exact. And they unleash a beating on him. And so, you know, PETA, now again, I was not there. This is what I was told, was that they then tell Boston Bob, you know, get the scumbag, you know, off the floor, get him back to the motel, keep him there. We're going to come, you know, to the hotel. We're going to cut his dick off and throw him in the dumpster. So Tracy helps get this guy off the floor. Boston Bob and Tracy walk him out, get him into the car. Boston Bob leaves and, you know, very astutely realizes, like, if I go back to this motel, they're going to come kill this guy. I left Boston with this guy. Everyone, a bunch of people know I left with him. He shows up dead in a dumpster. This is probably going to come back on me. He opts not to go back to the motel. Now, maybe he was trying to do the citizen duty and not get Billy killed either. But he drives, you know, straight off Long Island, drives back up to Boston. He basically dumps Billy at the hospital, basically just, you know, pulls up to the front of the hospital, leaves him at the door and heads off. And Billy, that's the end of, you know, Billy. I did have one interaction with him. I get a phone call in the middle of the night. I actually get a text, and it's basically the trip's off. We'll explain later. And so at that point, I'm like, well, what's this about? And I'm trying to reach Billy. I'm trying to reach Boston Bob, not having any success. At some point, Billy does call me, and we had one very short conversation. And it was, his thing was, get out. Don't do this. Get out while you can. I'm out. You're never going to see me again. Phone goes dead, and true to his word, never saw him again. Now, I know, Dan, you had another part to that question, and that went on so long that I've forgotten. Oh, it was the Bennett murder. So, you know, again, prior to me becoming affiliated with the gang, prior to me ever setting foot on Long Island, there was an event and a party, and in a room where Hogman and Bennett were, Bennett was killed, and there's two different variations of what happened. The variations were, one, that he was, you know, he was using his long knife, and oftentimes they would do this, use their long knife, scoop out some coke, snort the coke, and then sheath the knife, and that he had passed out, fell forward, onto the knife, piercing, you know, through his eye into his brainstem and killing himself. So basically he killed himself. The other variation is that Hogman was passed out and that Bennett saw an opportunity to, you know, use a little bit of Hogman's coke. Hogman woke up, kicked Bennett in the back of the head, driving the knife through his eye into his brainstem and killing. Part of my endeavors as I was moving forward in this investigation was to get whatever information I could on this death, to see if we could put together what actually happened in that room. Forensically, it didn't line up. You know, there was reason to believe that there was more to it than just falling over onto a knife and killing yourself. And so that was something that I set out to do during, you know, the course of the investigation.
Certainly. Let's use this as an opportunity, Ken, to stop for a second for this commercial from Ritual. Gaps in the diet shouldn't be ignored. Over 97% of women aged 19 to 50 are not getting enough vitamin D from their diet, and 95% are not getting their recommended daily intake of key omega-3s. Ritual's Essential for Women 18 Plus multivitamin was formulated by exhaustive research to help fill nutrient gaps in the diets of women ages 18 plus. It is formulated with nutrients to help support brain health, bone health, blood health, and provide antioxidant support. They invested in a gold standard university-led clinical trial to prove the impact of Essential for Women 18 Plus multivitamin. Essential for Women 18 Plus was shown to increase vitamin D levels by 43% and omega-3 DHA levels by 41% in 12 weeks. The clinical study was published in leading scientific journal Frontiers in Nutrition. My wife Lisa started taking Ritual's Essential for Women 18 Plus multivitamin about 3 years ago. She was very impressed with the results, and so when Ritual came out with a multivitamin for men 50 plus, I decided to try it for myself. It's been over a year now, and it has made a significant difference in how I feel every day. Right now, Ritual is offering my listeners 10% off your first 3 months. Visit ritual.com/murder and turn healthy habits into a ritual. That's 10% off at ritual.com/murder. Now, Ken, we were just talking about you're on the precipice of joining this. You have some allies. You have a state attorney, Mike Sullivan, in your corner, and you also have Andy Anderson at the ATF that is supportive of what you're going to do. Now, before we start telling everybody about your journey into the being a prospect with the Pagans, this might be a little bit out of order, but what is the main thing you needed from and permission for from this agency for this to be effective in being a prospect and working your way up to the hierarchy of the Pagans?
Well, you know, part of any of these investigations, particularly long-term undercover investigations, first of all, they don't happen that often, and the approval levels go to the highest spots within the government. But in this case, you know, we're fortunate because Mike Sullivan was the U.S. attorney. He also happened to be the acting director of ATF at the time. So he was wearing two hats, which was really helpful. And Andy Anderson was the special agent in charge of the Boston Field Division. Both these guys are extremely supportive. But, you know, they wanted to be brief. They want to know, hey, what's the goal here? And for me, you know, again, it was never the plan that I was going to be doing the long-term undercover, at least out of the gate. As we went further and further down the road, it was apparent that it was not going to be an opportunity to swap somebody else in there. But, you know, even at this stage, we're not 100% there yet. But we knew with the investigation what we were going for. And I knew that for me to be involved in it, I wasn't looking to, you know, bust a bunch of people for stolen motorcycle parts and some things like that. That if we were going to do this, we were going to do it right. We were going to do an infiltration, try to get to the highest levels of the group, understanding that all sorts of things can happen on any single day that can end the investigation, whether it's being your identity's compromised or an event that's going to take place that you can't participate in. So part of this was to get the approvals to do the things that you would need to do. And so there's internal approvals you get through ATF, and then there's approvals that you would get with the U.S. Attorney's Office, and also a willingness for them to prosecute this type of investigation. Because what's the point if you're going to do all this and there's not an interest in prosecuting it? And that was never in doubt. They had a large interest in prosecuting this group in preventing them from spreading any further.
So you talk about being a prospect, and so you gain the trust of these people very quickly. For example, the president, J.R. Eberling, and he invited you to the communion, to the first communion of his son. So impressive stuff. And you said at every one of these points, at every one of these events, every thing that you were invited to, they use it as an opportunity to find out more about you, like they would find out about anyone. But you found out soon enough what they were in. Obviously in a war with the Hell's Angels. That's one thing we didn't mention. But so soon enough, you realize what they wanted you for specifically.
Yeah, as this goes on, you know, again, we say, you know, we build a trust quickly. And I guess you'd have to define quickly. But for me, it seemed like it was an eternity. But you're going back and forth, and you're, you know, attending different events. You're staying at different, you know, places, and you're getting to know and meet different people. And you're being social. And part of this is you're really telling them what they want to hear. And you know, you're invited to certain things, and you go to these things. And so you're building up that kind of. It's like anything else. Anytime you meet anybody else, you know, you don't know that you're really sizing somebody up, but you are. You know, you're kind of evaluating, is this type of person I want to hang out and have a beer with? Is this somebody that, you know, I want to become friends with? Or, you know, is this somebody that, you know, really has no qualities that I'm interested in? So that's kind of that dance. You know, it's all one-sided because I know what I'm meeting with and I know what my objective is, but they don't. And so convincing them that you are something that you're not, which is one of them. And so that process goes on. And then as you're doing that, they are trying to find out about you. So like, hey, where do you live? Where do you work? You know, what do you do? You know, have you ridden with any other gang? Like, you know, and it happens gradually. And some were very diligent in doing it. Some of them are just BSing. You know, they're just having regular conversations. They don't really care. Others were not. Others were there to check your story. And, you know, one in particular, who ultimately became my sponsor, was Roadblock, and he was very diligent in asking a lot of questions. And he would ask a lot of questions and then re-ask them after some time. And I often get asked, you know, hey, how hard was it to keep everything straight? And I use this analogy, you know, if you told me you went to, you know, if I asked you, hey, tell me a lie about where you went to dinner, who you were with last night, what did you eat, what restaurant, what was the interior looking like? So you'd be fine. You would tell me a lie and you would lay it all out. You know, I had a steak, it was medium well, you know, I went to this restaurant and so forth. And that's fine. That's easy. But then let a week go by and I come back and say, hey, Dan, you know, last week you were talking about this restaurant and what did you have to eat and how did you have it cooked? And that's the hard part because it's not a real memory. There's no natural recall back to an event. You have to go back to a lie. And keeping that straight is very difficult. And they know the weakness to that as well. And so Roadblock would constantly be testing you with those things. And of course, the further you get in the process, the more documentation in things that you had to answer. Like there was a formal process of a whole lot of, you know, background information they asked, and they went and checked up. And they regularly checked up on me throughout the investigation. They did surveillance. You know, I would set my my bags up on my bike so I would know if anybody went into them, and they regularly went into my bags and rifled through them to see what was in there. So, yeah, they do their homework there. There's a reason why they've never been infiltrated before, because they're very secretive and they're very good at what they do, and that just means, you know, that we had to raise our game.
You talk about that, and I know I'm jumping ahead here, but we won't be able to go into a fraction of the stories that really make up this incredible book. But to demonstrate the vetting process and the testing and the mistrust that they have initially, and that is why they haven't been infiltrated till you came around. Talk about this. They talked about a drug dealer, a black drug dealer that had given them a problem. What did they want you to do?
Yeah. So they had, if it's the one I think you're talking about, they had, they had come to me. So I had just, purchased about an ounce of crack cocaine from Hogman and his source. And Hogman was armed, you know, with a firearm when we were doing this transaction. And when it was done, he's like, hey, bro, you know, hang around. And so I hang around in the crack dealer had left. And he goes, hey, listen, man, I've got some, you know, heavy work that I need you to help me with. And Hogman had just broken his foot in like five places. There was a pagan that that was out bad, meaning they kicked him out. And out bad means that no pagan colors, no, it can't be around pagans. If you see him, you're supposed to beat him. So Hogman had literally kicked this guy so hard he shattered his own foot in five places. And so he's like, hey, I need some help on this heavy work. There's, you know, a guy that we killed upstate, Tracy is another member upstate. He was actually the president of the upstate chapter. And, you know, we buried the body and we need to move the body. And I'm like, why are you going to move the body? He's like, the land's been sold where it was at. We're afraid that they're going to stop building. They're going to find it. Tracy's got a big lot where he lives. So we need some help in digging up the body, moving the body and reburying it. I'm like, all right, bro, you know, just let me know where and when. And so period of time goes by, you know, it didn't happen overnight. It did, you know, there was conversation about it. You know, I got recorded conversation about it, but there was no definitive time like, hey, we're going to go do it next Saturday. It wasn't anything like that. And so there were some, you know, in ATF who were like, ah, it's probably never going to happen. There were others who were very concerned about it happening. There were others who were very concerned that this could be a setup, that they figured out something about me or who I was, and that, you know, because this is in the Catskills. That's part of it. That was the bodies in the Catskills, and it was in the middle of the winter. In this particular area of the Catskills, there's virtually no one up there during this time. So, you know, fast forward, and all of a sudden it was like, we're going to jump in my truck, and Hogman and I were going to take a ride up there. And so, you know, I meet Hogman. He's got a gun on his waistband, which wasn't, he didn't always have a gun on his waistband, but it wasn't completely unusual that he had a gun on his waistband. He gets in the truck. Hogman is a very, about 450 pounds, very large human. And he pulls the gun out of his waistband, puts it in the glove box for the ride up, which is a couple hours. So we go up and he's laying out stories like, yeah, you know, this guy, you know, we ripped him for his drugs. You know, thought he'd just leave. He didn't. He got mouthy, so we ended up killing him. You know, we've wrapped him in a package, you know, and, you know, we've cut off his hands, and there was a hog farm not far, and Tracy, you know, fed the hands to the hog, to the hogs. But we need to get this body back up. And I'm like, well, how long ago? And he's like, oh, you know, like 6 months ago. So I'm like, okay. So he's like, yeah, we're going to get this thing up. We're going to move. So we get up there and, you know, it's February. So in the Catskills, it's freezing cold. So, you know, I'm thinking, how are we going to dig a grave in the middle of the winter in the Catskills? And so Tracy's like, yeah, no worries, man. I already put down some rock salt. And so he had treated the ground and let it sit. And lo and behold, it works. So if you ever have to dig a hole, Dan, in the middle of the winter, that's the way to do it. So we sit there in now it's daylight, and we've got a pick and we've got a shovel. Now Hogman's got the broken leg, so he's sitting on the side, and Tracy and I are digging this. And if you had an aerial cam, it would almost be comical, because at this point, you know, prior to going up there, ATF was very nervous about the fact that this now looked like it could be a setup. Like I was going to dig my own grave. You know, they were going to do whatever they're going to do, and they were going to bury me out there in the middle of nowhere. So, you know, I'm constantly, it was the one time that ATF demanded that I wore a wire, and wires create risk because they can be detected. If they're detected, you're not going to be able to explain it. So, but it was not negotiable. It was the one time I had to. And quite honestly, I wasn't, you know, totally opposed to it because I wasn't sure what was going to happen. But if you had the aerial camera and you were looking at the holes, we're digging this hole, it would almost be comical because it was like a dance. I did not want to turn my back to Tracy because I had the shovel and Tracy had the pick. And I didn't want him burying that in my back or my skull. And so we're moving around this hole and we're digging, and it's just not, it seems like it goes on forever. But eventually we get a couple feet down, the hole's done, and in again, it's daylight. So, you know, they're like, hey, let's go wait. You know, actually Tracy had some errands he wanted to run. So we're bouncing around, believe it or not, he actually was filing his taxes of all things, which I get, apparently some bikers file the taxes. So we go back to the house, and then a Hogman to get high, and, you know, hanging out there for it to get dark. Eventually it gets dark. We, head out, and the plan was we were going to take Tracy's truck and my truck. Hogman would drive my truck. Tracy and I would go in his truck. We'd pull up to the area, go into the woods, dig up the body, throw it in the back of my truck. Hogman would just immediately leave, and we go in different directions and meet back at Tracy's house. So Tracy jumps out of the truck. And again, now it's dark. There was a moon out that night, but now it's like, okay, the hole could have been a whole roost. You know, now we're out in the middle of the woods. You know, it would take nothing for him to off me out here. Nobody's ever going to find me. So he jumps out of his truck, and first of all, Tracy had a gun on him in his waistband, which Tracy very rarely had a gun on him. So that had my, you know, my alert up. And he jumps out of the truck, throws it in the park, jumps out of the truck, and kind of darts into the wood. He's like, come on, he darts into the woods. But I got to get out of the truck on the other side. And I had some knee issues, so I wasn't moving super fast. But he's gone. He's into the woods. So I'm like, man, this really could be a setup. Now, I did have a gun on me. And so we're moving through the woods, and I can hear him, can't really see him, but I'm making sure to keep trees between me and him. You know, so at least I've got somewhere to kind of duck behind. And called out to him. He's like, over here, you know. So, you know, I'm following the voice, but keeping these trees between me. And we come to kind of a clearing in the woods. And I could see his hands because, you know, there was enough where the moon was shining through. I could see his hands and there was nothing in his hands, but there was a huge tree down on the ground. He was on the far side of that tree. So I approached the tree. I could see his hands. And he's like, "Hey, I dug it up earlier so we didn't have to deal with that." And behind this was a tarp and it was, you know, wrapped, you know, around a body. And he's like, "Come on, you know, grab your side." So I grab my side again. He's got nothing in his hand, so I'm not now no longer really worried about the gun. We carry, you know, we carry the body out, and it's as we're carrying it, you know, we're lifting up because we're trying to get through the brush, and there's like liquid. It reeks. It smells terrible, and there's liquid just pouring out of the tarp, and it's pouring. You know, depending on where you are on the hill, like as we were going up and down, if it's tilted more my way, the liquid would, you know, come out on me, and I'm sure it came out on him too. So it's just, you know, really nasty. Going through, finally get out of the woods, throw it in the back of the truck. Hogman takes off. Tracy and I get into his truck. We both smell like shit. And we drive back a different route, but we go back to his house. Once we get there, we, you know, reach in the back of the truck, grab, and I can feel like what feels like an arm. And, you know, I'm lifting it up. He lifts it up. We bring it over, dig the hole. We bring it over the hole, put it in the hole. We then dig, you know, put all the topsoil back on, stomp it down, put more of the topsoil on, try to make it look as natural as possible, which is pretty difficult in the middle of winter. And then we're done. And we head back into his house. Hogman and him get high again. Roblox calls Hogman, and Roblox and Hogman were half brothers. And he goes, "Hey, have this conversation with these guys." And so we go in this back room, and he says, "Hey, talk to my brother." He said, "None of us are going to ever talk about this again, not amongst ourselves, not with anybody else. You know, we did what we had to do here. It's done. Don't ever bring it up again." So it's like, okay, yeah, whatever. Now, we jump back in the truck. We're heading back to New York City. And you know, I got mud all over me, my boots, you know, whatever. And Hogman's openly talking about, you know, why and how and everything else, you know, the murder on the way down. So he clearly wasn't following this. But for me, part of it was like, all right, I now know that Roblox is involved in this conspiracy. I don't know if he's involved in the murder itself or just a conspiracy to cover it up. But I know he knows because his brother was on the phone with him. They were talking, and then he relayed what his brother had said to him. So, you know, it's a dance. Like, how, you know, how am I going to find out if Roblox really did know? And so we ended up going back to the clubhouse on Long Island, and Roblox was there along with JR. And we went in, and JR made a comment about my boots because they were covered in mud. And I said, "Yeah, you know, we were up there taking care of that thing, trying to see, you know, I was trying to elicit a conversation from them that they knew what we were doing and so forth." And Roblox shot me a look like, and he said, he goes, "What was that you were going to say?" And I'm like, and it was clear, like, "Hey, you were warned not to talk about this and shut your mouth." And so I took the notice and that was that. So, you know, I know that went on for a while, but it's not the simplest of stories to tell.
Let's use this as an opportunity to stop for a second for these messages. Now, Ken, we don't have too much time, but we were your success in being a prospect with the Pagans is benefited by the circumstances with these guys as well. We didn't get into the savage beating that you avoided just by luck. You were temporarily kicked out of being a prospect and then brought back in. And that was just a sort of a technicality. Somebody that vouched for you was out. So then the people that you had built this relationship with, the president, Roblox, his half-brother, Hogman, Izzo Davis, the guy you were dealing drugs, you were able to deal drugs. You talk about the experience of being in a small town and the entire town paying homage to this gang, almost like celebrities, and them going into clubs and you witnessing them paying protection, the bar owners' protection to the Pagans. Basically them controlling this entire town. You also got a house thanks to ATF, and eventually all of these people trusted you enough, incredibly, to perform church, to have church. And tell us what church is, and tell us a little bit about this place that you had wired for sound and what exactly the evidence that you gathered at this recorded church meeting of the Pagans.
So church, and this is consistent with all motorcycle gangs, how they conduct it is a little, you know, could be different gang to gang, but church is where there's nothing holy about it. It is where they do all their criminal planning. It is a mandatory event. It usually happens on a weekly basis. Some chapters will do it bi-weekly, but at least once a week. And this is where they talk about their criminal activities, what they're going to do, how they're going to do it. And there's rules about church, meaning there are no electronics allowed. And it started off with, you know, you had to take your battery out of your cell phone. And then they realized that, you know, they could have, you know, there's other ways to use cell phones to transmit. And so no electronics at all. There were times, depending on what the subject matter was, we'd be stripped naked. We'd be sitting there naked. And these are some ugly human beings that you're sitting there with. So yeah. nothing enjoyable about that. There were other times where the chapter, the Sergeant at Arms had a RF detector, which is used to, you know, detect RF signals. So if there's a transmitter in the room, it picks up on that, and they would want us to see if we had an RF detector or if we had any sort of RF signal with us. So they would conduct these meetings, and in these meetings, you know, sometimes it was just regular internal chapter stuff and what was happening in their bars and, you know, who they might've been extorting money from or what plans they were to do, whatever criminal activity they were going to do. Other times they're talking about just chapter business. Some of them got more intense. Some of these church sessions would be much bigger and they bring folks in, mother club members or other chapters. And we were fortunate enough, you know, as you mentioned, I had an undercover house and over time built the trust with them, and it had a basement that was better. Most of the time we had church in the president's garage, and they would run like a heater to drown out noise, and they were very surveillance conscious. But the basement, particularly in the winter of my house, was better, and they liked it, and they built up the trust. And I had some hidden cameras and microphones in the basement. And so this one particular church session was a big one, because they brought in all the chapter presidents from Northern New Jersey and New York. And they also had the mother club member who was in charge of that entire area, Kano, come to this church session. And they were particularly heated about the beating that you alluded to that had happened, which would have been me if I hadn't got kicked out of the club. I would have been pulling guard duty, but because I had gotten kicked out, ultimately I got back in, obviously, but Roblox was doing guard duty, and the Hells Angels rolled up a whole pack of them with their support clubs, and they beat Roblox near death, beat him with ball peen hammers. He was air flighted out. And so the retaliation for that was being planned in this particular church session, along with some other criminal activity. And it was the first time ever that this had been caught on video. And not only was it caught on video, and audio, but you could see us being RF detected, during the meeting, and then you hear and see the conversation. So it was a big part of the criminal conspiracy for the prosecution.
You talk about the again, we don't have too much time to go into this, but it's incredible that you had a wife named Ange, three daughters that were very, very understanding, because you had to really go and dedicate 2 years of your life to a different persona. And you talk about your wife being involved with ATF recently, before that, previously. Well, she was an agent at the time. So the thing is, you had an extraordinary support team with your wife and your kids, so understanding. But after a couple years, and like you say, all this disgusting and hair-raising events, there's so many times that when you write about a recorder going off and making some noise, you're very, very creative, luckily, for the things that you had to say and do spontaneously to keep your cover in this investigation. So it's a very exciting book that we really didn't go into all the, again, I can't even imagine the stress from the possibility that you might be found out. And these guys, as you say, were very, very vigilant in trying to determine whether you said who you were, as you had said.
Yes, they certainly were. They had their processes, and you had to go through it, and they were constantly checking you. And, you know, you made, reference to some of these things. And so there's skill sets involved in it. There's technology, there's techniques. but there is just dumb luck. And, you know, me being kicked out of the club for that period of time and Roblox got beaten. Another quick, and I know we're coming to the end. We were on a run and there was like 30 of us. And we got back to the chapter president's house and he had sent myself and Hogman out to pick something up. And now, you know, I moved up in the ranks and I was now the sergeant at arms within the chapter. So I was an officer. And so I was the highest ranking. So highest ranking rides front left. So we pull out. Hogman, who is the vice president, doesn't have any real status, but he pulls out around me because he was annoyed that I had become the sergeant at arms over him. So he pulls out front left. Well, I don't really care, right? I'm not a real biker. So we're going down the road. And within a quarter mile, as we're making a turn, Hogman gets wiped out by a minivan, splatted on the road, actually codes out at one point. That would have been me. Should have been me. Because it wasn't Hogman's fault. It was actually the minivan driver's fault. But that's the kind of things that would happen during this investigation. And to your point on stress, it was every day. Every day that you had a plan, it never went according to plan. It might have the first 10 minutes, and then all of a sudden some curveball was thrown at you. You're going to do this, or they talked about this. And so you always had to be on your toes and adapt to that plan and hope it wasn't something that was going to have to shut down the case or worse.
You gathered information successfully with Church and with all these recordings. And it's very exciting when you talk about using opportunities like your cover story that you were a lobster, a poacher, so that you could go and meet with the cover team to give them the kind of evidence from the recordings and any other and fill them in on what was going on. These guys had to live almost a similar life to you, depriving themselves of their normal family lives. You were successful with some very significant sentences, and you were successful with basically all the charges that you were intending to have these guys convicted of. Just tell us a little bit about just the conclusion of the case itself.
Yeah. The takedown, as we call it, it occurred. It initiated with Hellboy. So Hellboy was an interesting character, MMA fighter. When he was strung out on meth, extremely violent. And this is a story we don't have time to go into. When they actually, a Mother Club member wanted me to kill him, but he was a source of meth, and I had been buying meth from him over a period of time. And it was determined it would be safest to get him to come out, you know, do a meth deal with him and have him taken off as a buy bust afterwards. And then that would start, you know, all the search warrants and arrest warrants that were going to happen after that. So I met him. It was about 2 o'clock in the morning. The deal went down. And as he left, he was stopped and arrested. And they, you know, when they brought him back to interview him, they basically told him, they said, hey, you know, my club name, as you know, Dan, was Slam. They said, hey, you know, Slam is a cop. You know, he's an ATF agent. And Hellboy refused to believe. He's like, no way. He goes, I believe a lot of people might be a cop, not Slam. There's no way he's a cop. It is dawn rose. They did all the executed all the search warrants and arrest warrants across five or six different states, brought all the evidence in, interviewed all the suspects. And then just fast forward, because I know we're almost out of time. You know, the legal process went on for, by the time the last defendant pled out, it was about 4 years. And that's just not because they, you know, they would go through all the different motions of trying to suppress different pieces of the evidence. The evidence was overwhelming. They, you know, ultimately were not successful in suppressing, you know, the evidence. And they all ultimately end up pleading guilty and receiving sentences, you know, varying sentences.
It's very, very interesting, too. I don't want to give too much away, but there's so much that we didn't even talk about and all the fascinating stories. But the body that we went on and talked about, that the body that you had moved and put in the ground, if we talk about elaborate tests, what did you discover about that body?
Well, almost every step with them was a test. And so, you know, it's not just the body. It's, you know, all of a sudden, you know, I would have PETA come up to me and be like, hey, you know, could you, let me see your gun. Is this ATF issued? Like literally would say ATF issued. And it's like all the agencies, why are you picking ATF? Do you know something? There's another time, a photo. It was, and what he's looking for is reactions. And that's what they're always looking for. They're always trying to make you uncomfortable where you might say or do something. And there was a time when right before I got kicked out, you know, that you referred to earlier, where they, you know, I called the cover team to say, hey, this change of plans. They now say I have to go back to Long Island. And that wasn't part. And the cover team was nowhere near me. They had already gone north. And so they were probably about 2 hours from me. And they had said, well, just get on your bike and go. And I'm like, no, you know, I don't know if this is a test. I don't know what, you know, but I've got to follow through on this. And ultimately what it was, they didn't know how to, you know, tell me that I was being kicked out of the gang. It had nothing to do with me. The national vice president was beaten out the night before. And because he vouched for me, anybody he vouched for was out. So they, you know, that was another test. Like, are you going to stay? Are you not going to go? And ultimately I got kicked out and then they ended up bringing me back in. So it was a constant mind games. It was physically very difficult. It was oftentimes I had lost 7 or 8 pounds just over the weekend from not eating during prospecting phases, feet bleeding. But it was mentally as much of a chess match as it was a physical.
Absolutely. You write that you retired in 2019 and you had a proud moment when your daughter, one of your daughters, became an ATF agent herself.
Yeah. My youngest, I presented her with my badge upon her graduation from the Federal Law Enforcement Training Center. And it was a very proud moment. She, I'm sure, will go on to chart her own investigative course. And I think she's going to be a terrific agent.
You have some of the souvenirs from your time as a prospect for the Pagans, and you also do consulting and also just talk about your experiences. Tell us just a little bit about that before we say so long.
So I, you know, for me, I do talk to law enforcement groups and I do it for a purpose of, you know, trying to encourage others to do the same type of work. I think it is one of the tactics that can be used to get to the higher echelons, to get to the leadership, because oftentimes they insulate themselves and you're not getting there unless you do these types of investigations. And so it is a big commitment. Agencies, you know, shy away from this because they are high risk, you know, both for the agents, but there's all sorts of things that can go wrong during the course of these investigations that have in the past. So I try to encourage folks to not shy away from it, to take this on and really look at these groups. They're extremely violent. And they wreak havoc in the areas that they are in, and that we owe it to, you know, to these citizens to do what we can to eliminate these groups.
Well, I want to thank you very much. It was a very courageous and very fascinating book, Riding with Evil, Taking Down the Notorious Pagan Motorcycle Gang, with former ATF agent and author Ken Croak. Thank you so much for this interview, Ken Croak. You have a great evening. Good night.
Thank you.